This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sometimes people ask, why does God allow war? I don't know the answer to this, but war is a terrible thing, sometimes a necessary thing, that dramatically affects everybody involved. Sometimes war has meaning, and sometimes it has none. However, there is one constant. Those who suffer the most have nothing to gain from its outcome, and had nothing to do with starting it. Charles E. Summers, photographer of the U.S. Army's 166th Signal Photographic Company in World War II. Greetings, Scholar Warrior. CJ here. Welcome to episode 191 of the Dangerous History Podcast. And for this episode, I'm going to present to you a conversation with one of the three co-authors of a fascinating new book entitled Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers, published by City Files Press. But real quick, just a few things before I get into that. I know you've not heard from me in a while, nearly a month, and I've been working behind the scenes but haven't been able to finalize an episode since the end of my Halloween specials. Partly this is because I've been dealing with more health sort of issues. I was struggling still for a little bit of November with getting my chronic pain situation under control. Finally got it dialed in, and then within just a matter of days of really getting that squared away, then I injured my back badly and spent 2 weeks suffering pretty badly with that. At its worst, I could hardly hobble around any great distance. So while that doesn't stop me from doing things like researching and reading up and, you know, working on research for things like the next DHL lecture and things like upcoming Woodrow Wilson material, that sort of stuff does take the wind out of your sails and drop your energy levels down. And the other thing it does is it prevents you from sitting in certain positions for extended periods of time, like, you know, sitting in my swivel chair at my desk working on note composition for upcoming DHP episodes. So anyway, it's been rough, but finally, I think it's all over after dealing with basically 6 weeks of abdominal pain and then 2 weeks of severe back pain. Fingers crossed, knock on wood, I think it's finally over. And I've been able to, in addition to getting back full bore on the DHP over the last week or so, I've been able to get back more to the exercise routine I'd been doing up until all this stuff started to happen. And so that also has been helping me to feel better and get my energy level back up to be able to run and do all the other things I want to do. You know, I'm going back to martial arts this week after being away from it for a while. So I'm very happy about that. And hopefully this will enable me to kick back up the production of DHP episodes to what it had been before, say, mid-September. Also, I just briefly want to mention that it's, as I record this, the beginning of Thanksgiving week, which means Black Friday and Cyber Monday are coming up. And so I just want to remind you, if you're doing any of that sort of shopping through Amazon.com, please, if you want to help me out a little bit, go through any of my Amazon affiliate links on the website. And even if you buy things other than, you know, what I have links to, I'll get a little kickback from Amazon for whatever you buy at no additional cost to you, and that is one of the many great ways that you can help keep the DHP chugging along and help support my work. All right, so I was turned on to this book, which was published pretty recently by a longtime listener, friend of the show, someone whom I've had the pleasure to meet personally at one of the times I was in New Hampshire about a year ago, and that is Kathleen. So shout out to Kathleen. Thanks for sparking this episode. Kathleen let me know that her brother is actually one of the three co-authors of this book that we're talking about today. And that is Mark Jacob, who I'm going to be speaking with in a moment. I'm going to share with you my conversation with him. But real quick, before I launch into that, I just want to share with you super brief bios of the three co-authors, who are Richard Cahan, Michael Williams, and Mark Jacob. So Richard Cahan is former picture editor of the Chicago Sun-Times and is the author or co-author of around 20 books. Michael Williams, a well-known Chicago photo historian, is the co-author of more than a dozen books. And Mark Jacob, to whom I'll be speaking, is former Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune and former Sunday editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, and he is the co-author of 8 books. So all three of these gentlemen who cooperated on this book, Aftershock, have extensive experience in these sorts of matters. And they went through some significant archives of World War II military photographs, many of which are being seen by the public for the first time. And Mark was kind enough to send me an electronic copy of the book before our interview. And so I had a good number of days to look at it, and it is just an excellent piece of work and lots of different emotions looking through all these pictures. Really gives you a window into the human tragedy side of World War II that you often don't get in the sanitized kind of Disney-fied version in mainstream American discourse. So anyway, it was a great conversation that I had with Mark Jacob, and I highly recommend this book if you're at all interested in a view, a window into the reality of World War II that you just won't find anywhere else. So here we go. Here is my conversation with Mark Jacob, one of the three co-authors of the recent book, Aftershock. Okay, Mark, thank you for taking the time and joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
So you are one of the three authors of the recently published book, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. And if you go to the history section of any brick and mortar bookstore, if you find one of those, or any library in America, and go to the history section there, you'll usually find that there are way more books on World War II than probably on any other historical topic. And yet, you and your co-authors decided you still wanted to add another brick to that gigantic pile. So, I have to start off with, how did you all get started on this project, and what made you decide that, despite all that, still there needed to be at least one more World War II book thrown into the heap?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, because if it was just another World War II book, you know, what's the point? People could just show up at the library. But we decided to do it a little bit differently. Just a quick thing. I'm working with the three of us. Work with City Files Press, which is based in Chicago, and the basic mission of that publishing company is that they look at old archives of photos and try to make new statements with them. You know, for example, a recent book that I was not involved with, but my two co-authors, Richard Cahan and Michael Williams, were, was a book called Un-American, which was about the Japanese incarceration during World War II. And they've got old photographs from the camps, et cetera. And so, they've done tons of books. I've done a few books as well, you know, on old photos. I did, Richard Cahan and I did a book on old baseball photos, et cetera. So it's not just war related, but looking at old archives that maybe, at the time were not fully, exploited by historians, and that there may be some kind of hidden treasures in there. And the World War II photos that we looked at were photos from the U.S. Army Signal Corps from the last year of World War II, from 1945. And there's more than 100,000 of those in the National Archives at College Park, Maryland. And so what we did is, went through and looked at them, and we're just kind of looked to try to make new statements, and also trying to find photos that just had not been fully kind of exposed and were not showing up in, the old books. So we try to tell a new story. The thing about this collection, it was the U.S. Army soldier photographers went out and took a bunch of pictures, and they were wanting to document the war and documenting what the Army had done and documented, the damage of the war and, the accomplishments of the soldiers. But it was also used for propaganda. And to some extent, looking at it 75 years later, you just look at it in a new light and you want to make new statements. There are some pictures in the book that certainly would not have been published 75 years ago.
Yeah, you've already pointed at this a little bit, but I'm interested in hearing more of what you think. Why do you think that the U.S. military and the U.S. government were so interested in trying to document this war photographically as extensively as they seem to have wanted to? I mean, I could be wrong, and you could correct me if you know otherwise, but I'm assuming that no other major combatant government in World War II devoted as much resources and manpower to photography of this sort as did the U.S. military.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have a complete answer on that. I suspect that other countries did, but maybe not to that extent. Frankly, the Soviet Union was trying to survive, and et cetera. So there are photo archives like that, but not like the U.S. The U.S. was in a kind of a unique position in World War II, which is why it came out of World War II as the world's, main superpower. The war wasn't fought on its ground. It had a lot of casualties, but compared to other countries, not relatively as many casualties. And the U.S. had so many resources. And I think that's why you have this kind of amazing collection. There are even separate, Navy and Marines photo groups, too. So there's an amazing number of photographs taken of this war.
So, can you tell us a bit about kind of the nuts and bolts process of how you went about working on this in terms of like the research and the curation and all that for putting together this book?
Sure. And that may help explain, answer your other question about why it's different, because we went to the National Archives and looked at the photos, and they have the photos kind of in, folders. They have them out there where you can look at the prints of the pictures, and, went through them and decided what we wanted to scan. And we had access to be able to scan the negatives, which is one big difference. These were mostly 4x5 inch negatives taken with speed graphic cameras. If you've ever seen those old movies that show press photographers, and they're holding these big cameras. They're the speed graphic cameras, most likely. And they're a little difficult to operate, but they take, they take beautiful 4x5 inch negatives and with a lot of information on them. And so scanning those negatives with modern equipment means that these photographs look way better than they've ever looked before. They just jump off the page in the book. And they're just, all the hues and the all the tones of them really come out. And so one of the things we wanted to do is make these really fascinating and stark pictures look better than ever before. So we, scanned them all in and just went through the editing process. I'm a former editor at the Chicago Tribune. I was a Metro editor, and Richard Cahan, one of my co-authors, was picture editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Michael Williams is a longtime photo historian as well. So we really know how to handle these kind of collections and how to look for kind of the hidden treasures. And, you know, I feel like we found them. And when we would find pictures that we didn't know much about, we'd go through this kind of journalistic process of investigating and trying to figure them out. Here's just one example is that we saw this picture. It was a beautiful picture. It's in the book of a group of Chinese relatives who were in mourning. They're dressed in for mourning, and they're at their feet are boxes of skulls and bones of their loved ones. And this was taken in the Philippines in 1945. And we didn't know a ton more than that. But we started kind of looking around. The internet's a wonderful thing. And we figured out that, that this was the, you know, we knew these were Chinese diplomats. That's about all we knew. And we found out that the daughter of the, we tracked down the daughter of the consul general in the Philippines, who's still alive. She was 11 years old when World War II was happening, and tracked her down. And she had all this really interesting information. She had never seen the photo that we showed her because she and her mom had gone to the United States already, but she knew everyone in the photo, and yet she'd never seen the picture. And she told us that she thought her father's remains were among those. But she told us a fascinating story that what happened was the Japanese invade the Philippines. There were like 100,000 ethnic Chinese living in the Philippines Islands at the time, and then a consular staff of about 8 people in the Chinese consulate. And the Americans, you know, Douglas MacArthur and et cetera, they were leaving the island. They left troops at Bataan and Corregidor, who mounted a, you know, stern defense, but eventually surrendered. Anyway, the MacArthur was leaving, and he volunteered to take this these Chinese diplomats with him. And they said, no, we're going to stay. We have to, you know, advocate for all these ethnic Chinese on the islands. So what the Japanese do is they arrest the diplomats. They demand that they get, that they collect a huge amount of money from the ethnic Chinese and for, you know, to support the Japanese war effort. The Chinese diplomats refuse, and the Japanese march into a cemetery and execute them all. And so all their families spent the entire war in the Philippines, not knowing what had happened to their diplomats until after. But this story, you know, was told but to us by somebody who was actually there. You know, the daughter of the consul general, who was one of the people murdered.
Wow.
And so tracking down things like that, you know, I hate to use the word fun when we're talking about horrible things, but, you know, for a journalist, looking at a picture and trying to figure out what the story is behind it does have some fun aspects, because you can, you know, you're doing, you know, some investigation. You're just trying to figure out how you can find things out. Another example, for example, was that there was a picture of the meetup between the Russians and the Americans in Germany when they were, you know, coming at the Nazis from both sides and about to close out the war. And they, when they met up, they often had, you know, festivities, banquets, things like that. And we have a picture from a banquet where a Russian general is awarding a pistol to an American general. And they had the name of the Russian general, and it was, you know, definitely wrong. The thing, just to remember, these soldier photographers were traveling all the time and under difficult conditions. And so sometimes the information on their captions wasn't great. And they had this guy totally wrong. We knew that because we couldn't verify the name. And what I did is just sent an you know, email out to 10 Russian scholars at American universities and said, hey, who's this guy? Can anyone help? Got 3 responses. One of the people who responded sent my email on to a Russian diplomat in Europe. She sent it on to Medvedev University in Moscow, and the history department at Medvedev University identified who the person was, who the general was. So, you know, you get help from people if you ask. And we just found a lot of stories that we, you know, we tried to tell the stories behind these amazing pictures.
Yeah, I noticed that. I've been looking through the book over the past week or so since you sent me a PDF copy of it. And, you know, I was struck by a number of things looking through it. One being, as you mentioned earlier, the picture quality of the photos is not what most people would expect from that era. It looks like it's HD in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was
and another thing
with how the book turned out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So very, very well done as far as that goes. It's just striking. But another thing that I noticed was, as you were just sort of alluding to, the detailed captions for most of the photos that, you know, give you quite a bit of information on what it is you're looking at, and oftentimes the names of some of the folks in the pictures and everything like that. It's really, it humanizes the war and makes it vivid in a way that, you know, we rarely get from such a distance of time. And I noticed, and I'm sure this is something that you all were striving for, that I noticed and I appreciated that this book contains a lot of pictures of the sort that most coverage in books and in documentaries of this war only includes a little bit of, if at all. And I mean things like photos of dead and maimed people, photos of destroyed cities and homes and buildings, and also something that you don't often encounter, which is photos of displaced refugees who are fleeing from, you know, one place to another for one reason or another and that sort of thing. So
yes, I agree with you. That's the refugees thing is something we especially were struck by because, you know, during the war, a lot of the photos that the U.S. Army was, you know, that were being published were just showing kind of, you know, GIs because that was a big part of the story. But this was total war. I mean, this was a war that, you know, spanned the globe and in which everyone was a target. And unlike some previous wars, you know, there were way more civilian casualties than combatant casualties. The death toll, according to one estimate, was 3-1 as civilians and soldiers. So, yes, the book really tries to kind of show what the effect of years of war have been on, you know, on civilians as well as the soldiers.
Yeah, and I think that's something that often gets lost in the narrative that Americans get of this war. I'm sure it's different in the countries where, you know, the war was happening right in their country. I'm sure it's a very different take the way the Russians or the Chinese or the Germans or whoever, the Japanese, the way that they kind of see the war. But the American version, because we were at such a distance and almost no American civilians died in the war, that we lose sight of the civilians getting killed and then also the civilians, even those who didn't get killed, being homeless refugees and all that. And, you know, so it's a sad story, but I think it's an important thing to put back into the narrative.
Well, and another example of the kind of picture that's in this book that you wouldn't have seen otherwise is kind of a tough picture to look at, but interesting, is a picture of a dead horse along a road in Germany. And these German villagers are out and they're picking off pieces of the horse to eat because they're so desperately hungry. And as the war was about to end and after it ended, there was great hunger, you know, in Europe. You know, everyone's food supply, civilian food supplies had been, you know, destroyed and everyone was short of food. And this is the kind of picture that you just wouldn't have seen. I don't think you would have seen at the time. You know, that there was nobody, you know, no one in America wanted to show a picture that was going to make you sympathize with German villagers in the last days of the war. They were, you know, obviously complicit in what their government had done.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's a desire. There was a desire at the time and perhaps ever since to on the part of the U.S. government or at least, you know, important people in it, to kind of prevent average American people from really thinking about the plight of civilians in the enemy countries, right? That you're kind of supposed to either just not see it at all, or if you do see it, you're supposed to sort of immediately dismiss it as, well, they're all guilty, sort of the William Tecumseh Sherman argument that, well, they all kind of, you know, civilians in Germany and Japan deserved whatever happened to them. And, you know, it's harder to dismiss it so lightly when you look at a vivid picture of what this actually looked like.
Right. I don't think you can, you know, deny the responsibility. The Americans have the same responsibility for what our government does. But the book is, you know, I mean, we're not in the book trying to like say this person's, you know, bad person, good person. What we're trying to do is just really show a picture of what all these years of war had brought to the world. And I mean, we went to the title Aftershock because we felt like the last few days of the war and the, you know, immediate aftermath said so much about, in effect, it was an inventory of what war had brought and what it wrought. And also, to some extent, since it's 1945 and we're getting into the atomic age, it also shows the new world that's being created. I mean, we have there's a picture, an Army picture of the Trinity nuclear test, which was preceded the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we have pictures from Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the Army photographers got there. Also, there's a picture of Jewish refugees, you know, dancing in their camp, getting their awaiting travel to Palestine. There's a picture of Vietnamese protesting that they want their nation to be free and independent because, you know, as you know, the French occupied Vietnam before the Japanese took it over during the war. And then when the Japanese were defeated, you know, instead of the Allies giving Vietnam, you know, independence, the French took over again. And so there, and we know how that ended up for the United States. So the book kind of does look backward and does look forward in a way that's kind of striking. We also tried to say surprising things, both in the pictures and, you know, and in the text. For example, and I learned some things as well. For example, Nagasaki was not the initial target, was not the prime target. That bomb was supposed to be dropped on the city of Kokura in Japan, but the weather was bad there, so they went to their secondary target, which turned out to be Nagasaki. So, hundreds of thousands died because of the weather. Yeah. You know, it's just the vagaries of war. And so I hope the reader will learn and there's not a ton of text. It's not something a big slot to slog through. They'll page through the pictures and see these just amazing photographs, but also the text will illuminate people about, you know, some of the things about the war they didn't know.
Sure. Yeah. Another aspect that I appreciated that often gets just left out of the narrative, and it's one of these things that for most Americans is an unknown, is the parts of the war, the theaters of the war that, while quite significant in terms of territory and numbers of people involved and all that, are just completely out of the narrative in the American view of the war. Things like China, Burma, India, those sorts of places that you managed to find some photos of what the war looked like in those places. And I think that's another one of those things that most Americans, you know, would really learn from in looking at this book, that, oh, wow, there's this whole theater of the war that we don't know anything about.
Thank you for noting that, because that we really tried hard to do that, to make it not just this kind of simple, you know, fighting against the Nazis and fighting against the Japanese military empire, but also, I mean, not just in Japan, not just in Germany. We wanted to make it really clear that this war spanned continents and that it touched so many lives. And there's a really nice picture of a Buddhist temple in Burma, just when the Burma-Lido Road is opened, and the area has been destroyed by the Japanese as they left. That's in there. And I don't think, there's as in everything, there's just a limit to how much attention people can pay to things. And there are so many stories in World War II. One thing that was illuminating to me was just how vicious the fighting over the city of Manila was at the end of the war in the Philippines, and how the fighting for the walled city was just so vicious and the Japanese refused to surrender. There's a good picture in the book that shows a Japanese POW with crutches, and he was one of only 30 Japanese that surrendered during the fighting. All of the rest of them fought to the death. It's just kind of amazing. And so we learned things about different aspects of the war that we just had escaped our attention.
So what would you say was your overall goal when setting out to do this project? And did that goal change or evolve at all over the course of working on it? Because I'm assuming that it was quite a long time that you devoted to putting together this book.
Yeah, a couple of years. And, as it turned out, there were two goals, and one of them kind of evolved more than the other. The first goal was we knew that there was this kind of huge collection of photographs, and we just, thought we'd look through it and see if we thought it could make a book. And we were instantly, you know, convinced that it would. And it seemed like an interesting story to tell the story of these soldier photographers. And that is an interesting aspect of the book, just all by itself, is all these GIs, drafted or volunteers, who went into the Army and, you know, got trained in photography and became photographers. And most of them had no professional photo experience before the war. One of them, for example, was sold cameras in a camera store in San Antonio, but some of them had nothing to do with photography really until the war. They were trained. They were trained in movie cameras and also in still cameras. And then they went to their specialty and then went set out. And these guys, because they're not, you know, they weren't hardened press photographers who'd seen murder victims and seen fires and disasters, they approached it different than journalists would. They were, in effect, just regular people who had been trained in photography and were thrust into disaster scene after disaster scene. And so some of them after the war wrote memoirs or wrote their impressions. And the book has a lot of that, a lot of quotes from them and what their experience was like, and, you know, just how affected they were by what had happened. There's one story in the book where a photographer says that he's encountered a group of people who he thinks are within, you know, a half hour of death. They're just dying. They're about to die. And he left his camera to take a picture, and then he just put the camera down and did not take the picture because he thought it'd be disrespectful. And, you know, the book, I think, tells a passionate human story about these press photographers, these soldier photographers, and what they went through. Beyond that, a kind of an evolving secondary mission or goal in the book was to depict what total war looks like. World War II was the biggest disaster that we ever faced, and the devastation is just you know, awesome, it's just shocking and sad, and we wanted to make that clear what total war was. You know, I gotta tell you, CJ, as we were talking about this and working on the book, we kind of developed this thought that modern Americans have a very limited view of what war is. Contemporary Americans, for example, you know, we're in the middle of the longest war in American history right now. Right now, we're fighting in Afghanistan. It's been going on since 2001. That's 18 years longer than ever any other war, any other conflict in U.S. history. Yet, it doesn't affect most people's lives on a daily basis at all. The sacrifice that's being expended by Americans is really limited to a very small slice of Americans. And almost all of us are able to go about our day with virtually no thought about it. And what does that mean? I think it kind of means that Americans don't think about those sacrifices by others that much. And they have a view that war is distant and painless to them and perhaps, you know, just limited and minor. And I think we wanted to tell these Americans of 2019 that war affects everyone. And it's also that it's not this idea of limited war, or you can control what'll happen, is a fantasy. And once you start a war, you never know where it's going to go, and you never know who's going to be affected. And I think we wanted to make a kind of an anti-war statement. You know, the more we looked at these pictures, the more we thought that the book should make a statement that people need to understand what war is and educate themselves on that, so that in the future, you know, when they or their governments, you know, are facing the prospect of war, we know what we're getting into, which I don't think we do now. I think most people, it's vague to them. It's something they see in movies.
Oh yeah, I would agree with that entirely. And I think it's particularly powerful anytime. And I try to do this in the classes I teach at my day job. And I've tried to do this from time to time when covering war on my podcast. such as, you know, I did a huge long Civil War series and tried to dig into as many sort of dark, neglected aspects of the war, like homeless refugees and civilian suffering and all that, that just gets left out of the story, that that it's particularly powerful when you're showing things like this that are from World War II, because World War II is always the one that is characterized as the good war, the clear-cut case of pure good versus pure evil, and the good guys won and the bad guys lost, and it's that simple, and there's nothing else there are no subtleties or nuances or all that sort of thing. And so to show some of this, you know, frankly, kind of darker, more disturbing sides in a lot of cases of what's supposed to be the good war, the one that nobody is supposed to question or ever, you know, have any doubts about or whatever. So in that regard, I think a book like this, you know, is potentially pretty powerful to at least cause some people to ask some questions and think some thoughts they otherwise might not.
Right. And even in a war like World War II, where there was a clearly villainous enemy, you know, and where you were fighting Nazi fascism, and so you couldn't not fight that if you were a good person. Even in a case like that, I think there's a takeaway, there's a lesson that people in democracies or people need to worry about their government. They need to keep despotic leaders from taking over. I mean, you know, what happened in Germany was not. It happened over a period of years, but, you know, in effect, a civilized nation became the most depraved nation on earth. And how did that happen? So I think even in when you're talking about a good war, you know, there are just plenty of lessons to learn. Also, the U.S. was on the side of the right, in my opinion, for sure, and did a lot of good to put down kind of murderous regimes that were causing pain to millions of and death to millions of people. But, you know, everything's not black and white. I mean, there's a picture in the book that shows, in effect, an American massacre. And this is the kind of picture that it's been published before, but it certainly isn't very commonly known. And it sure as heck wasn't published during the period when it was taken. This is when the U.S. Soldiers liberated the Dachau camp and, you know, just saw just the most depraved treatment of human beings possible. And can you imagine being one of the first soldiers into Dachau? How just shocking. And I mean, I don't know what it would make you feel about the possibility of human beings and what horrible things they're capable of. But anyway, so these soldiers became furious. They were angry. They were appalled. And they rounded up all the SS guards and they lined them up against a wall and they got a machine gun and they loaded it. They put it in front of them. And as soon as the first round went in the chamber, the SS guards broke and ran. And as soon as they did, everyone opened up on them and shot them. So at least 17 SS guards were killed in that incident. And there's a really good picture in the book that shows some of the SS guards still not having been shot, but many of them falling along the wall or lying along dead along the wall. It's an amazing picture. And the army did do an investigation of that and did not charge anyone. I mean, obviously most people wanted the depravities of the war to be, you know, in the rearview mirror and not, to, you know, to dwell on them. But still, that's the kind of picture that's in the book, because it helped tell the story of the war, but you never would have seen it at the time.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, other than some of the ones that you've already mentioned in our conversation, what come to mind for you as some of the most surprising, striking, even shocking? I mean, a lot of things fall into this category, but the ones that really stood out to you, things you discovered while working on this book, photos that stood out to you above the rest for one reason or another? What are some other ones that really?
Well, you know, I think there are some, I love some of the pictures in the book there. I mean, many of them, they're just great pictures and they just look so good. A picture I like that's not, you know, super, you know, horrifying is a photo of a British guy who's lost a limb, who's riding a bike, and he's riding a bike in front of a group of soldiers who have lost limbs who are sitting in wheelchairs watching him. And that is, he's teaching them how people who've lost a limb can ride a bike. And to me, it's kind of this symbolic aftershock kind of picture, because it's positive. It's people trying to, get past the war and learn how to survive afterward. But it really says a lot about the legacy of the war, that many people even who survived were forever, wounded and maimed by it. But it's a beautiful picture, and almost kind of a light picture. It's just an odd, pretty picture.
Yeah, that one stood out to me too. That was actually one I was going to mention if you didn't. That one also, it's a really good composition. The photographer who took it really had an eye, because it's just a beautiful composition.
And this is a little off subject, but did you notice that that I'm looking at the picture now, and did you notice that every picture in the book is full frame, including all the numerical notations and the whole frame of the whole negative?
Right.
That was a decision we made. We decided that we would not crop any of the pictures. We would use the pictures as evidence. We would scan the whole thing and run the whole thing, because you see, like in the side, it'll say Aegea safety film, which was the name of the type of negative it was. And so you see all these notations but you also just see it full frame, and you see it just as it was taken. So there are two things about that. We wanted it to feel like evidence, and we also wanted to remind the reader that somebody took this picture, that there was, that this was not just sort of disembodied product of the war, that it was a human product, that some person took great care to, and many people took great care to take the pictures. But I guess one picture I'd love to talk about is the cover photo. And the cover photo is PFC Jack Pulliam, a picture of him. And, it's we felt like it was the perfect photo for the cover, because it just says Aftershock, the Human Toll of War. It just goes with the title so well. And so it's just a simple portrait of a guy, but he has the most exhausted look on the face that I think I've ever seen. He has this 1,000-yard stare in his eyes, like he's just seen great horrors and is changed by them. And he's wearing this cap at a kind of an odd tilt on his head. And Jack Pulliam was from Pennsylvania, and we tracked down his family. They live in Colorado now, and we told them we wanted to use the photo on the cover because we thought it was just a brilliant photo, and I think they were thrilled by that. And they sent us a 19-page memoir that Pulliam had written about his experience. And so let me just tell you about that. So Pulliam was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was captured on his 20th birthday during the Battle of the Bulge. So he's captured by the Germans, and they march him and many others back to Germany to work as slave laborers. He does that for about a month. Then he and a comrade escape. He's hiding in a house in Germany, and a German officer comes in, and Pulliam kills the German officer and to avoid being recaptured. And then he hides in a fruit cellar, and the advancing Allies come and discover him. And the picture that's shown on the cover is him right after the Allies, took him back in, and he has this just shocked, exhausted look on his face. And that cap he's wearing is the German officer's cap, the cap of the officer he killed in order to save himself. And in the memoir that his family shared with us, he ended it with saying, "Captured once again, but this time in the right hands."
Wow. Yeah, that is a haunting photo. And you know what it called to mind for me was that photo, I think it was on the cover of Time magazine or something. The photo from maybe whenever it was, 15 years ago, of the Marine who had just gone through the Battle of Fallujah. And he's got that same just, shell-shocked look. I think he was, smoking a cigarette. His face is all covered with dirt and grime and whatever. And he's got that same just haunted look of a guy who's been through hell.
Right, right. And he had, you know, it's that picture just, we thought, really told it. There's another picture in the book that's got a kind of a good story. I think one of the most satisfying things about doing this book was, I mean, we aimed for pictures that were beautiful and also said a lot, but discovering kind of the stories behind the photos really kind of made it. This was another step that made the book really stand out, I feel. There's a picture in the book that shows a Soviet prisoner at Buchenwald. He's a, you know, from the Red Army, and he was put in the as a slave laborer. Actually, I'm not sure he was in the army now that I say that. Think about that. He may just have been from the Soviet Union. Anyway, he's made a slave laborer, and he's just been liberated. And so the picture shows him. He's wearing that kind of striped suit that all the, you know, the camp inmates wore. And he's angrily pointing at a German soldier, a guard who had brutalized prisoners at Buchenwald. It's just this great shot of him just angrily just pointing his finger at him, like, this is the guy who did all these horrible things. And that picture has gotten a little attention. That was published, you know, at the time. But the story behind it is kind of fun, or interesting at least. The photographer, Harold Roberts, always felt bad about that photo. And that was because he was using his Speedgraphic camera, and there, which holds two cartridges with negatives in it. So you can take two pictures at the same time, or, you know, in succession. And then you have to, you know, take those cartridges out and put two fresh ones in. And so he took this famous photo, and he was pulling the cartridges out to kind of change the film. And the inmate hauled off and punched the SS guard in the face. And so Harold Roberts always felt like that he had missed a photo that would have been even better than the one he took.
Right. Yeah, I remember that one. Another one that stood out to me was there's a photo in there of the inmates, the slaves, who were being basically worked to death at the Nordhausen rocket factory. And, you know, it's one of the dark sides of the war that has been pretty visible for a long time has been, you know, the Holocaust death camps and all that. That's one of the things that most people have at least seen a little bit of the images of those horrible conditions. But the Nordhausen rocket factory, not many people know about that, and how the guys who ran that, many of them later, as part of Operation Paperclip, were saved from justice and brought to the United States and went to work, you know, for the military or for the space program or for contractors that do those things. And, you know, with Von Braun, who basically ran that place, being the most famous. But when you know the history of Operation Paperclip and all that sort of thing, then when you look at that photo of just how awful it was for the unfortunate people who were forced to work at that rocket factory, it just really, I mean, makes you wonder about that decision to save those guys from justice.
Yes, that's an interesting thing, and that sense of the, we have to forget the past because we have to think about the future mentality is, you know, definitely a part of this book. Yeah, because, you know, the Soviets were our allies in the war, yet it was clear they were going to be our adversaries afterward, and so that's, you know, that's why the U.S. felt like it had to go easy on Von Braun to, you know, to just for the future and future technology. You're right. But they, you know, yes, they made decisions that to let some evil people off. The whole slave labor system in Nazi Germany is fascinating to read about. I didn't even know it was called Operation Paperclip. That's interesting. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, there's some good books out there on it that have been published relatively recently, because, of course, a lot of the details of that whole thing were kept secret for a very long time, because they actually fabricated personnel files and records for these guys to make it look like they had not been the ardent Nazis involved with horrible things that they in fact were. They you know, the OSS basically would, like, falsify backstories for these guys and then bring him to the U.S. and give him good jobs.
That's fascinating. But, you know, that's, again, that, you know, that's, they would argue that, you know, that was the past and that they had to worry about kind of protecting the future. And It's tough. The interesting thing about the, you know, this whole post-war period, the immediate post-war period, there's a photo in the book that I also like of General Patton giving a speech to troops who are about to go home. And that gives us an opportunity to explain how, you know, Patton didn't think the war was over when the war was over. I mean, he, you know, frankly would have just decided to go after the Red Army, the Soviets, you know, if it had been up to him. There's a, you know, he wrote in his diary at this time, he wrote, quote, "We can no more understand a Russian than a Chinaman or a Japanese. And from what I have seen of them, I have no particular desire to understand them except to ascertain how much lead or iron it takes to kill them. The Russian has no regard for human life and is an all-out son of a bitch, barbarian, and chronic drunk." So that's the way he thought of how this ally is the Russians. So, so the post-war period is interesting. There are also, as you noticed, photos in the book of, for example, the black market in Vienna after the war, all these kind of shady characters in the square who are, you know, trading merchandise. And it was the post-war period is fascinating.
Yeah, there have been a few well-reviewed books coming that have come out in recent years that deal with that, which I've not read. They've been on my giant, you know, list of things to read, but that deal with the first year or two in Europe after the war, just how chaotic everything really was, and how, you know, in most coverage in history books and documentaries and whatever of World War II, it's like it kind of ends and then pretty quick you're supposed to be back to normal, and thanks to the Marshall Plan, right, Everybody's doing fine and Germany's becoming a great industrial country again, whatever. And in reality, it was like several years of real chaos and deprivation and
right,
all this.
They called it the rubble era.
Yeah.
They go in Europe. And there's another thing that's, you know, that gets to the whole idea that you're talking about, that when the war is over, the war is not really over. And is the idea, there's a picture in the book that shows a 16-year-old German kid named Heinz Petri. And he was tied up and put in front of a firing squad weeks after the war ended. He was part of a guerrilla group called the Werewolves that was planning to continue fighting against the Allies even after the war had been lost and Hitler was dead. And that's a kind of a fascinating photograph as well, you know, that this teenager is going to be executed by the Americans, you know, weeks after the war's ending. And, you know, there are also pictures in the book of the war crimes trials and like that, to where there was a heck of a lot of cleanup to be done after the war ended.
Yeah, and some of these groups that had fled as refugees were trying to get home, and sometimes governments are forcibly moving people around from one place to another.
I really like the pictures of the kids being sent out of Vienna to other parts of Europe to be taken care of because there's just not enough food, or their families don't have enough wherewithal to take care of them in Vienna in the year after the war. And I thought that was really compelling. And as we were doing research for the book, we read about how some of these kids, child refugees from Vienna had gone. I think they went to the Netherlands, if I'm remembering it right. And as adults, as senior citizens, they went back to the Netherlands to thank them for taking care of them during that time period.
Yeah. So a case of someone doing something noble, someone doing something humane in this terrible context. Yeah, it's always kind of nice that there are these little bright spots of some people doing decent things and altruistic things.
Speaking of that, let me tell you one story that I want to make sure and mention to you. So there's a portion of the book of a woman named Amalie Mary Reichman, and she was a Jewish slave laborer who was part of a group of slave laborers who were put on these forced marches by the Nazis. You know, as the Germans were retreating, oftentimes they would take their slave laborers or their POWs with them, sometimes, you know, on the road, and they would march them hard and they would feed them little. And so the death rate among them was just awful. And ultimately, Amalie married Reichman and about 100 of other women who had been slave laborers. They were taken to just a barn and abandoned by the Nazis. They could hardly walk. They had no food. So they were, in effect, they were put into that barn for all of them to die in that barn. And the Americans came upon them, and a medical officer was with them and treated them and got them, you know, food and carefully took care of them to where many of them, majority of them, survived and were very grateful to him. And that medical officer, that doctor, his name was Aaron Cahan, and he is the father of one of our co-authors, Richard Cahan.
Wow.
And so that's kind of a cool connection with the book. And Amalie Reichman, is her picture's in the book. It was a picture taken just after she kind of had been, when she was being nursed back to health. She had never seen this picture. She went to the National Archives a few years ago just to look for pictures, and that's the first time she saw the picture of herself that had been taken by the Army Signal Corps photographers. The many of the women from that group that had been abandoned in the barn wrote my friend and co-author's mom to thank her for all the great feats that my co-author's father had done, you know, saving those people's lives. Interestingly, and this goes to show how, you know, finding things in archives can be a trick. My co-author Richard Cahan went looking for his father's picture in the archives and couldn't find it because they spelled his name wrong in the caption. Finally, he ran across it, but he'd been looking for quite a long time. Huh. They spelled it Cohan. So that's the thing about archives, is that you spell someone's name wrong, it could be lost almost forever.
Right.
But that's a real emotional connection to the book for us, is, you know, Rich's dad was, you know, part of these events.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
Save people's lives.
Yeah, that's a heck of a story. So you've already touched on this in a few places in our conversation, but I wanted to just, as we're getting ready to wrap up, kind of zoom the lens out a little bit again and ask you, what lessons, like kind of big picture takeaways, do you think that this book has to share with its readers? What do you think that the thoughtful, perceptive person who has a look at this book is likely to glean from having a look at these photos and the text accompanying them?
Well, we're all photo editors, and we like, you know, we picked out a few little pictures, so a few pictures that showed kind of devastated cities, you know, just rubble, just, but mostly we looked for faces and we looked for people. And I think that a reader looking through this book will connect up with the faces of people and will realize that it wasn't, you know, this wasn't a war that affected millions. This was a million wars that affected a million people in different ways. You know, everyone had a different experience, but people were, almost everyone was affected by it. Nobody could really escape the war. And I hope that what people get out of it is just this sense of humanity and kind of kinship with people. For example, you know, from different places, you know, the picture of the Chinese relatives with their kin's skulls and bones, you know, just, I mean, I'm hoping the reader will sympathize with these people who lived on the other side of the globe and who, you know, they would never have met, but the connections. I think that what we really want is to people realize this was a world war and affected people all over, and we all have so much in common with each other, and we all kind of owe it to each other to avoid doing this again.
Yeah, very well said. I agree with that completely. Well, Mark, it's been great talking to you about this book. The book is fascinating and visually striking, and I would urge any of the listeners who think this sounds interesting at all to go and check it out. But I want to thank you very much for taking the time today to come on the podcast with me.
Well, thanks for your interest. I mean, I do hope people will pick up Aftershock and give it a look. And I think they'll be captivated by it.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to the Dangerous History Podcast, and I hope that you found some value in it. If you have and you'd like to contribute to my work, there are many different ways that you can help out. One that costs you nothing but maybe a little bit of time and effort is to help spread the word about the show to anyone you think might be interested in it. There are also a bunch of ways that you can financially assist me to continue doing the work that I do and to continue making it better as best I can as time goes on. The most helpful way, and the one that gives you potentially a lot of value back in return, is to sign up for a recurring contribution via either Patreon or Subscribestar, and the links to my Patreon page and my Subscribestar page will be in the show notes of this episode. I now have multiple levels of support via either Patreon or Subscribestar. For $2 per month, you are at the Apprentice Scholar Warrior level, and you will get access to all of the vintage DHP episodes, meaning the first 52 episodes of the show, which are no longer available to the general public. And of course, you'll get the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping to keep this podcast going, and you'll have my gratitude for doing so. For only $5 per month, you will be at the Journeyman Scholar Warrior level. And for this, you'll receive the benefits of the $2 Apprentice Scholar Warrior level, plus access to special bonus DHP episodes that are available nowhere else, as well as access to ad-free regular DHP episodes as they come out, and you will be eligible to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. For $15 per month, you will be at the Scholar Warrior level, and you'll get all the benefits of the Journeyman level, plus access to Dangerous History Lyceum course lectures as they are produced and released. And for $25 per month, you'll be at the Master Scholar Warrior level, where you will get all the benefits of the $15 Scholar Warrior level, plus additional benefits, still to be determined, but probably including but not limited to a regular live chat. You can also make one-time or recurring contributions to the Dangerous History Podcast via PayPal or Bitcoin. And another great way you can help out my work is by clicking on any of the Amazon affiliate links on my website to do your Amazon.com shopping. And if you buy stuff after going through any of those affiliate links, I get a little commission at no additional cost to you. And this helps me to buy supplies, research materials, etc., to keep making the podcast and making the podcast better. I also have an Amazon wish list of things to help me out with the Dangerous History Podcast and related productions that I put in the show notes of episodes. It's mostly research materials, but also there's some stuff in there, hardware for audiovisual production, etc. So if you want to order me something off there, that also helps out. Your support and contributions are what keeps this thing going and keeps me doing the work that I do. So I hope that you will consider helping out. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast. As always, doing my best to help you learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future.